How are you too far? Too far left.
Please don't ask that question.
P-E-R. Period. Can he ask it just period? Not
yeah,
then
sure.
anything.
Yeah. Well, I don't think I'm too far left. Some people think I'm extremist. But I don't think there's anything extremist about wanting drastic changes to save the environment, to get off oil-fueled economy. I don't think there's anything extremist about cutting major, a bloated military budget of the kind we have. I don't think there's anything extremist about using the resources of the country for the needs of the people instead of for the aggrandizement of a few leaders. The extremists are really already in power. But people will say you're extremist. It doesn't take much to be extremist nowadays. Or too far left.
I have noticed that. How? But do you have H-O hope?
Yeah, I do have hope. You get very discouraged because the powers that be are ruthless. They are very clever in misleading the general public, but they also have been showing their hand. The further they go in pursuing their agenda, the more evident it becomes what it is they're after, that they're not supporting the interests of the ordinary people. And we've seen last year, we saw millions of people all over the world demonstrating against the war in Iraq before the war ever even happened. That's unusual. I never saw that before in all the wars I've demonstrated against. And in such numbers, too. People, in a sense, serving notice that they didn't accept a global monarchy that would rule over everybody and decide when it could attack a country, what country it might want to attack, who shall live, who shall die. So I think you do have people doing something different and something more now. There's greater awareness, I think, now than 3 years ago, that we're in a very difficult and dangerous situation.
But the WA, the war, did happen.
Yeah, I never thought the demonstrations would stop the war, not for a moment. Yet I took great heart that these demonstrations took place because they registered and it was a wake-up call to the ruling class that they did not have the world behind them. They fooled a good segment of the American public, but not the publics of any other country. 90% of the people in Spain were against that war. And just about every country from Japan to Indonesia to Lithuania to Finland to Italy to England to Mexico to Canada to Nigeria, there were substantial demonstrations. And what that did do is put a limit on how they've behaved in Iraq. They've killed, they've murdered, but they've had to pretend that they're there to build democracy, to save Iraq, to reconstruct it, to teach them self-rule, teach them how to have a civil society. Here's a country that's 5,000 years old, I mean a civilization that's 5,000 years old, and U.S. leaders were presuming this. So they're pretending to behave like the New Deal in Iraq, while they're, of course, here in this country, they're undoing all the gains that we've made since the New Deal, and some even before. So it's the only restraint you have on the ruling class is their sense that there's opposition, that they will not be able to elicit the empowering responses when they want them. When Richard Nixon came to his wit's ends in the Vietnam War, and he said, and the White House tapes showed this, he said, let's go and let's bomb all of North Vietnam, let's take it out, let's use nuclear weapons on them. And then he turned to Kissinger and he said, I know you're against that, you think that's too terrible. Of course Kissinger didn't think that was too terrible, and Kissinger corrected him. He said, no, Mr. President, I don't want you to do that, because I know you'll be known as the butcher of the world and there'll be a tremendous uproar if you do it. So he was being restrained not by any moral or ethical considerations, but by a fear of the reaction of the people around and below them. And in Vietnam, of course, they had a very unusual situation there, because you had resistance permeating right up into the military ranks. You had units that would not make contact with the enemy. They go out, platoon, squad size, mutinies, even one or two company, as big as companies, mutiny, refusing to go on fighting. Things were getting very difficult. That was also another reason they went to an intensified air war, but also eventually had to pull out.
In that HAPP, is that happening in Iraq?
Well, yet? Nowhere to that level. There are no instances of U.S. troops fragging their officers. Fragging was using a fragmentation grenade and rolling it under the officer's tent or something and wreaking severe injury on him. There are no instances of units refusing to go out on the road, but there most certainly are troops in Iraq who are disillusioned, who many of the reserve units, just for self-interested reasons, realize they're going to lose their standings, their school programs, or their businesses, or their jobs, or whatever else, because they're being held longer than the time they had to be, which is a form of conscription when you hold volunteer National Guard or reserve units longer. They thought if you get in the National Guard or the reserves, that's, 1 weekend a month, 1 week a year, whatever. And, of course, it's disrupted their lives. So a lot of them are unhappy about that. Some of them some of them are still gung-ho. They think they're doing good work for America, and they're on a crusade of some kind. Some of them have still totally bought in to the whole mythology that's perpetrated by this administration. Can we open a window a little bit? Because there's something with the cat here. It's getting me. I'm starting to.
Yeah. In HIST history is it getting be better or worse
in history
for us people?
Well, I don't know. In history, you mean throughout the whole expanse of history? all the way?
Yes. Like, you mean like if you kind of were looking at it linearly, like where we are now, would you say it's gotten better for people than it was?
Yeah, in some ways it's gotten better. That's why I supported the Russian Revolution and the Chinese revolutions and all those revolutions. I mean, you took countries where you had hundreds of millions of people living in utter misery and destitution, and plagued by famines, plagued by disease, starvation, malnutrition, and you turn these societies, hundreds of millions of people now have enough to eat, at least until the capitalist rollback, had education, had enough to wear, had health care of some kind. A gain like that, never before seen in all of history. People like myself, my family, lived in utter destitution. We were a poor Italian peasant family, both sides of my family from southern Italy. The people in southern Italy today and the people here in the last century have made enormous gains. Public education, better well-being. What the goal of the present rulers are is to get us back to 1900, get us back to no public services to speak of, defund public education, no public health care. You just go find some doctor on your own if you're lucky, if you can afford it. No environmental protections of any kind. So, yeah, we've made tremendous gains. How far you want to go back, to serfdom, to slavery. On the other hand, there are also things that are worse. The ecological crisis is, given modern industrialization and chemicalized and toxified environment, is worse and may be getting close to catastrophic levels. My answer would have to be there's no simple yes or no. In some ways we've gotten better, in some ways not.
L. A. Last week we had Ignacio Chapella as a guest. He's the UCB professor whose study revealed that the Mexican corn was contaminated by GMO corn. And as a result of that study and his general criticism of the corporate ownership of the universities got him to where he didn't get his tenure, even though everybody voted for him to get the tenure. And I think he's in the process of suing the university.
Yeah.
And we had him on along with the filmmaker Deborah Garcia, who made a film about food that he was part of. And her film apparently was used extensively in Mendocino that helped get people educated and when they passed the
no GMO
in Mendocino County recently. We talked about how REAL, real, C, change, C, O, comes from D, from S, M, small, and L, local, C, A, L, small and local. How real change comes from small and local.
I don't believe that at all. I mean, sometimes real change comes from small and local actions, and the changes are small and local. Sometimes these small and local changes can reverberate and impact on larger things. But a lot of times you have to mobilize and address the national and international questions directly. That's what the enemy does. They take over the White House, they take over international organizations, and their changes come down to us from large and global, while we're working on small and local. There's no reason to romanticize local struggles and think that there's a communitarian formula here in any way?
What is the R I right M I X? What is the right mix?
I don't know. It would depend on the issue, the particular struggle that's going on, and many times you're operating locally, but you're dealing with a national issue, or you're dealing with an international issue. So you can say that the February 15 international demonstrations against war all took place in particular locales, but there was an international coordination of them, and that was very important. It would have had no impact. It would have gained no visibility if it had stayed purely local and was not internationally organized, as it was. I'm talking about the February 15th, 2003. Mm-hmm.
S. So. Why. R. Why the. Why are. The. R. You. Ruling class. Doing things like P O L U polluting the A U A air and W and water when they be breathe the air and drink the water.
Well, they really don't quite drink the same water that we do, and they don't quite breathe the same air that we do. They live in areas where the air is a little better. Of course, there's no invisible shields. Ultimately, all this filth gets mixed into one atmospheric envelope and it goes around. But it's not, for instance, the same as the people living on the Jersey, near the Jersey Turnpike, or in, well, where I just was a few years ago giving a lecture in Louisville, Kentucky. I got there and the air was like hard for me to breathe, and there's a whole industrial rust ban along the way. In any case, those kinds of costs are diffuse and removed. The damage of those kinds of costs in terms of the 50% increase in asthma every 10 years that's happening with children all around the world. 50% every 10 years increase, and that's compounded now. The explosion in breast cancers and other cancers and all that, all the other kinds of things, those costs are diffuse. The causality is not that direct. They can easily rationalize it. If it means, look at it this way, if it means that you can get $10 million by stripping and destroying a natural forest that had certain species and had other things and had other uses and fishing and uses, and you can walk away with $10 million, you do it, because the gain is immediate. It's immense. It involves billions of dollars in the oil-fueled economy, for instance, hundreds of billions of dollars. And the costs are, the diseconomies are thrown onto the public for the most part. It's true some of that comes back to them. It's true Betty Ford got breast cancer, and others, but that's a small price to pay for your billions, hundreds of billions of dollars. I don't think we properly understand the mentality of the aristocratic wealthy class. Their wealth is their essence. They kill for that wealth. They will kill and destroy whole countries to maximize that wealth. Maybe you can get a sense of it if you understand the mafia. We always concentrate on the mafia. The mafia is penny, nickel and dime stuff. But it's exactly like the mafia. One of the earlier mafias I remember is the Roman aristocratic senatorial class, which I wrote about in my book, Julius Caesar, if you will. There it is. I got it in. I couldn't, no thanks to you, I couldn't wait for you. Couldn't wait for you to help me.
And
with
I
wait. Let me finish. I want to say something about the ruling. Stop it. I want to say something about the ruling class for a minute. What you had in ancient Rome, you had something called the ager publicus. It was the public lands in Campania, all around Rome. These lands were very fertile, and they were farmed by communal farms and by independent farmers. These lands were publicus, ager publicus. They were publicly owned, and the farmers rented it from the Roman state, paid a modest rent to the state, so there was income, public income coming into the treasury. They victualled all of Rome. They raised enough food for all the people of Rome. So here were people making a living, doing productive work, answering human needs, creating a market, and paying taxes for public funds. And this Roman aristocracy wasn't getting a penny of it. Now that's what a capitalist class or a serfdom, a feudal class is. It's a mafia. It now comes in and it gets its cut. It wants a cut of any human activity that's going on. That's why it has to be privatized, so that they can come in. The mafia made it that way. They go to a store owner and say, "You make so much a month. From now on, you give me $100 a week of that money." That's all. They just come in, don't do a thing, don't provide any service, they just get a cut. And that's what these guys are doing to this day. It's not the peanuts the way the mafia makes it, it's billions of dollars. They do not want any kind of activities, any public sector going on, any pension, disability, and survivor's insurance, which is what Social Security is. They don't want that. They're not making any money. It's billions of dollars, and they're not making a penny on it. It kills them. Public housing, the landlords don't make a penny on public housing. So that's what their passion is. So when you come along and say, pollution, so a river, but who gives a goddamn about a river? They're very good at attacking things that can't defend themselves. They're good at attacking children, the elderly, the disabled, and they're very good at attacking the environment, because the environment can't defend itself. The environment is there and seen as raw materials infinitely, which they can use indefinitely. They believe they have complete right to all the whatever natural resources are left in this world, that they have a right to access all of those resources to use as they wish. They have a right to dump their diseconomies back into that environment. That is their mentality. And the goal is to get richer and richer and richer and richer. As Marx said, there were three words he used in Capital, Volume 1, accumulate, accumulate, accumulate. And that's the madness that we're facing.
What will happen when there is no thing to accumulate?
Well, when they will go on doing what they do now. For instance, we hear that the Pentagon is now developing contingency plans for global warming wars. That is, this is the level of insanity that capitalism brings people to. They don't say this could lead to catastrophic disaster. They accept the catastrophic disaster. They don't say we should change our methods of production, our energy systems, our transportation systems, and all that, to reverse this. They say, this is coming And there are going to be many people, there are going to be massive riots, there are going to be whole countries where people will be starving or inundated by floods or by freezing temperatures if the Gulf Stream gets smothered by the melting ice, fresh water from the North Pole. And they're developing plans to, so those plans are simply the same pattern of response they're doing now, for instance, against terrorism. They don't say, we should change our policies because our policies are creating terrorists. The terrorists keep saying to us, we fight you because you are in our region. You're destroying our countries. You're taking over our countries. You're destroying our cultures. You're doing this, you're doing that. And so we want to bring the war home to you and all that. They don't see that. They say, oh, the terrorists fight us because we're, as Dan Rather said, he said, we're winners and they are losers, and that's why they hate us. Other of these right-wing media pundits who overpopulate the TV stations have all said the same thing. They hate us because we're free, we're prosperous, we're democratic, and we're secular. That's why they hate us. But when you read what they say, the terrorists who did the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, Osama bin Laden, several of his interviews, I've got them all in a new book I'm doing. They don't say that. They don't say, oh, we hate you because you're so free and prosperous and good-looking and all that stuff. They say, we want to get you off our backs. We want you to get out of here. We are retaliating. They see their war as a retaliation against the things that the U.S. have done. And the ruling class simply doesn't look at it that way, because they're using the terrorism war for their own agenda, which is higher military spending, larger permanent military bases through Central Asia, the Middle East, Africa, Southwest Asia. Everything the Project for a New American Century has talked about, they're doing. And so it's very clear that the war on terrorism, they don't want to end the war on terrorism. They want that war on terrorism to keep going on. I mean, Bush lets it out sometimes, talking about this is the first war of the 21st century. This is an era of perpetual war. There's a whole bunch of countries we're going to have to confront and all that. They want this to keep going on because it serves their purposes. It gives them runaway military budgets. It gives them a militarization of the whole society. It gives them license to go and attack and bomb and kill people all over the world and to build military bases. The plan is to finally put a global lock on all the resources of the entire world, a global lock on all the populations of the entire world, to impose upon all of those populations, including the one in this country, a free market system where there'll be no public sector, no protections, no regulations of any kind, where the right of capital and the powers of capital will reign supreme. It's a very rational policy. That's not my conspiracy theory. You can go onto your computer and just click in Project for a New American Century, and they got it all written up there. They put it up on their website now, their plan. Maybe I would take another piece of chocolate.
More chocolate. S. O. So. Y. R. Not the P.
No.
E. People are E. Revolting.
I think the people are rather revolting.
Nah, that's an old joke. They're revolting. They're disgusting.
Disgusting. I asked. A.
Is that going to be your contribution to this?
L. A. B. Labor. A. Activist from Argentina. Why did he think the people weren't revolting in the United States? He said that he thought because in the United States, the middle class still aspire to be the upper class and still think that it's possible. Whereas in his country, there came a point where that was obvious that that wasn't going to happen. And then the middle class didn't have as much to lose or didn't think they had as much to lose.
Yeah. American middle class has bought in on the dominant ideology. They also have been distracted in the way that the Germans were by Hitler, by conjuring up false enemies. Many of the white males, for instance, are convinced that they're being neglected. They're not getting anything. 90% of all government programs go to white males, but they're convinced the feminists are getting it all, the African Americans are getting it all, the gays are getting all this attention and whatever else, and undermining our life. So you got literally millions of people who are distracted by these kind of non-substantive arguments and discussions, and so they're being very successfully misled. Argentina is an interesting choice, your friend being from Argentina, because in Argentina we saw the breakdown of the capitalist state itself. That is, the capitalist state failing to do one of its two essential functions. It has two functions. One is to protect the capitalist class from the other 98% of the people, to maintain that social organization so they can accumulate and take it over. The other function, and this is where, in a way, right-wing capitalists, reactionary capitalists, are more dangerous for capitalism than the more liberal, enlightened capitalists. The second function of a capitalist class is to protect the society and the state and the capitalist class from elements within itself. What you had in Argentina was very interesting. A portion of the capitalist class devouring the rest of the capitalist class. I mean, the banks, the pension funds, and all these things just simply devoured by this rapacious group. You had the beginnings of that with Enron, WorldCom, and those things happening here too. So you always have this danger that there will be capitalists who will say, hey, why sweat, why bust my chops producing refrigerators or cars or gizmos or rot gut soft drinks and all that, and then hoping to sell them and market them. Why not just make money by going into tapping into money streams and tapping into investment streams and pension funds and things like that, and stealing billions of dollars? So this is what you had in Argentina, and the capitalist state did not protect its own class. Of course, it also wasn't protecting everybody else, because when the whole thing falls, it hits the ones on the bottom sometimes the hardest. So what you have in Argentina happening today is people actually reclaiming, workers taking over factories that have been abandoned in the public domain and starting to run them again, demonstrating that you don't need this mafia coming in and getting its 20-30% cut on everything that's done, and you can go and do it yourselves. And it's very heartening. The story in Argentina, and I hope your friend went into it a bit, it's been heartening, where the people have, you know, recreated currencies, invented some currencies of their own, have gotten into bartering and all that, and rebuilding a rather complex economy, and creating jobs, not just for the sake of jobs, but for services that were needed and all that sort of thing, and doing what human society did for millions of years before the capitalist mafia came along, you know.
That is a V, very D, A, dangerous model.
What's in Argentina?
Yes.
A very dangerous model for the ruling class. Yes, very dangerous model. I've asked Argentinian friends of mine, well, hasn't the usual thing happened? You know, the sabotage, the disruptions, the destabilization, the military coming. Says the military. He says the military is totally in disrepute. Nobody even looks at him or gives a damn about him. But I don't know. The military was in total disrepute elsewhere. I don't know why. I don't know why the U.S., the CIA, and the usual guys at the Argentine desk, I don't know why they aren't getting in there to block it and destroy it. Part of it, of course, is that the whole thing is such a basket case that they don't know what to put in its place, or it might become even more frantic, or I don't know enough about what's happening in Argentina. I'd like to see more. Now, now my emails are going to be flooded with stuff. I shouldn't have said that. Hold off a bit.
E.
Unless you really got something.
A. I heard. D. E. A. Dean. Howard Dean. Talking. To. R. Rich people. W. A. T. W. A. R. War. Warning them. This was after he dropped out of the presidential race. He was caught it on C-SPAN. There's a bunch of room full of rich people, and he's talking, and he was essentially warning them that they need to get hip to the fact that people are really upset, and he doesn't think that the rich people, the ruling class, know to the extent to which people are mad. If we want to maintain our control, we have to give them a little bit because they're getting really pissed.
Yes. That's true. It's called give a little to keep a lot. In fact, in my book, The Assassination of Julius Caesar.
And haven't you been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for this book?
That book has been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. That's right. Thank you for mentioning that. Did I get a shot?
Shot, Mikey? Yeah.
Now, the thing I'm watching on the screen,
no,
is that what
they're
seeing?
No, that's just the cam. I don't actually have the live stream.
So this is all live, what's going
this
on
This is
here.
Live. I'll
every,
put it
every
on
piece
up
of chocolate
here.
I'm eating, that everybody's
they
seeing
watch
this.
It.
I
they
thought it
watch.
Was off screen.
And it will play over and over again on public access. You might get a bunch of free chocolate from
the
company.
So when I was saying you holds up the book, they all saw that. Yeah. Well, it's good to know.
There you go.
Know what's happening.
See, this is, there's a delay there, so that's what they saw.
Why don't you put it on so we can see?
Yeah, I'm going to keep it on now. Yeah. I just never turned it on before, so you'll see the delay.
I'm sorry, I told you this screen.
I was S.
I wanted to tell you something. Answer your first question. In ancient Rome, the reformers, like Caesar, made that very point. They went to the Roman aristocracy. And they said, if there's no cooperation, there's going to be civil war. And he was right. Well, Caesar actually was more explicit. He said, if I am killed, if I die, that it's going to bring civil war. And it did. And how did he hope to prevent civil war? He hoped to prevent it by giving the people some piece of the action. In other words, land redistribution, because all that land I had mentioned before about the farmers owning, they had been driven off the land, and the aristocrats took over the whole. All the agar publicus was privatized and became their special latifundia. Rent easements, debt cancellation, a grain dole for the people who needed some food to get by. A luxury tax on the very rich. A limit, a very, very high limit, but a limit on how much wealth they could own. These were the things he was putting in. Now, for the ruling class, as I said before, this is akin to thievery. This is outrageous that you think you can put a limit on my wealth.
And they, H.A., had...
Hate.
Had him killed? No, had. K. I killed him, H, G.
They had to kill him.
You, guy, guys, who, T, R, try that. And they have to kill guys that, and they had killed guys who tried that before.
That's correct. For the better part of a century, they had killed other reformers before Caesar, and I treat them. And I did treat them, yeah.
So, why did Caesar T try it again, knowing that?
Well, the way the same reason people all struggle in countries, they keep trying it. Also, Caesar had an army at his back, and that's what made him even more dangerous to the ruling class. Unlike Tiberius Gracchus or Gaius Gracchus or Drusus or Flaccus or Catiline or Clodius, to mention some of the dozen or more who were killed. And by the way, not just they were killed, but hundreds and thousands of their followers were massacred in many situations. Not hundreds of that, hundreds and thousands of their followers. Caesar came along. One of the reasons he started rather advanced in his life, he already had been a consul, which was the highest office, and then he began his 8-year campaign in conquering Gaul. He went off and became a military hero, got an army, and that's why, and thought he would be able to, and in fact he did. You see, he came in and he was made consul in perpetua, dictator in perpetua. He was made in effect dictator of Rome, but he didn't shut down the tribal assemblies, and he didn't give all the power to the aristocracy the way earlier dictators had done. Mm. So you see, the Roman Senate didn't mind one man rule as long as that one man ruled in their behavior, in their interests. Mm. So here he had he took over, but he kept the tribal assemblies, he kept the secret ballot, he gave Athens, which he had reconquered in the civil war against Pompey, he gave Athens for the first time in over 100 years, maybe more, he gave them a democratic constitution.
Why did he do that?
Because he was much to the disgust of the Athenian ruling class, because they were the people who were on his side, because he was a reformist. Mm.
Yes.
And he maintained the democratic constitution with the Roman people. It's true, he started bypassing the Senate. And this is what all these scholars say, is he violated the Republic, he violated the Constitution. But he didn't violate. The Senate just would vote down anything he presented to them. He did what Tiberius Gracchus did. He went to the tribal assembly. He went to the people's assembly and got the things passed. And they, of course, supported these things because they were in favor of these reforms. So the one thing he forgot to do was his personal security. Mm. He kind of scorned. He said, to live under personal security all the time is to live in constant fear, and I can't do that. He thought he could, and here he miscalculated, we know with the benefit of hindsight, he thought he could take these leaders, and after the Civil War, they had all sided, they had all fought against him and all that. He brought them all back, gave them back all their estates, most of their estates, gave them back positions of responsibility in government. He thought he would be able to co-opt them, to box them in, get them to work for him. If he killed them, he thought, well, proscriptions, killing them, just leads to another round of hard feelings and grudges and blah, blah, blah. And so we have to try another way. He was trying a way of reconciliation. In a way, his fatal error was to deny the reality of class conflict, even as he engaged in that class conflict. He seemed to forget that this thing is for real, that these guys will kill you if you touch any of their interests. Just like any mafioso will, just like Tony Soprano will kill you if you touch anything he wants.
That,
assuming Tony Soprano is representative of any of this.
That is S-T-R
A. Strange. 4. Some. 1. Who. 0. P. E. Operates. In. That. R. Realm. R. E. A. Reality.
I'm not sure I know that. What is strange?
His behavior is strange for someone who operates in the class reality, that, like, him being part of the aristocracy. Like,
no, it's really not, Frank. It's not the usual case, but it's not so aberrational. It's not the class background you come from. It's the class interest you represent. Mm. You have people come from very modest class background, like Ronald Reagan, Richard Nixon, Henry Kissinger, and they are faithful servants. They become multimillionaires, and they become faithful servants of the wealthy class. And on the other hand, you can have certain people of wealthy background who ally themselves with a reformist element. And there was a pretty strong tradition in Rome. Caesar actually came from a family that had a very strong reformist tradition on his father's side. His mother's family was more conservative. They were with the oligarchs pretty much, but I think we don't know for sure, you know. But his father's family, his uncle by marriage was Marius, who had been one of the greatest of the reformers, or I think vastly overrated. He didn't have a consistent program, but he really gave it right back to the. To the ruling aristocrats, because he was not an aristocratic. He became consul. He came from common origins. His father-in-law was Cinna, who was Marius's first in command, you know, lieutenant, right-hand man. So, and Caesar's own father was a bit of a reformer. So from a very early age, he was already seen and looked at suspiciously by the senatorial class. He was a very commanding, very attractive figure. He was a very powerful public speaker, a good writer, and commanded the loyalty of people, including his troops. They were famously loyal to him, followed him everywhere. He also was a no good imperialist himself, and what he did to Gaul and conquering all of Gaul. You haven't held that book up in a while now, have you?
If you're interested in this, yes. You can read Michael's book.
The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome.
By?
Michael Parenti.
Ta-da-da.
New press.
Like?
So you do get reformers that sometimes come from upper-class background. And you get reactionaries who come from modest backgrounds sometimes.
2. K. E. Kennedy, like the two Kennedy brothers?
Yeah. Or like Franklin Roosevelt might be a better case. I mean, he really was American aristocracy. Yeah. Roosevelt had an older aristocratic genealogy. The Kennedys had Joe Kennedy, who was, you know, Irish, you know, from an Irish immigrant family who made millions bootlegging and, well, like, and, as they say, in any great family fortune, there's some crimes. If you go back, you find that either they were dealing in slavery or rigging railroads and stealing property or killing farmers for the coal mining, you know, or running guns or bootlegging or whatever. In every one of these big, great American fortunes, there's often scandal, swindle, outright crime, and that gives us our aristocracies.
I was S. U. Surprised. How. E. X. P. L.
I, explicit. D, E.
Dean was
in that talk.
Well, I saw McGovern do the same thing. When McGovern was running for president against Richard Nixon, he appeared before a group of Wall Street investors and said, you should give a little to keep a lot, you know. In the long run, this will be better for you. Unless we have some kinds of reforms, you know, America is going to destabilize. And that was not the way they decided to go. They've gone this way, which is a hard right solution, which means democracy itself comes under attack. Because once you attack the people's standard of living, they try to mobilize to defend that standard of living. Then you have to attack the democratic rights that they have won, which were used to defend that standard of living. In fact, that's the very reason historically they fought for those democratic rights. There are very few people who ever fought for democratic rights in the abstract. They always fight for these rights because it becomes a weapon for a more decent material life or social life or cultural life, whatever it is. But the early workers wanted to be paid better wages. They wanted to be able to support their families in 1820s, 1830s in America. To do that, they had to organize and exert a pressure against their owners and have strikes. Well, combinations, organizing, they were called combinations. We call them labor unions today. Combinations were illegal. The courts had decided this was unconstitutional. This is a violation of equal protection of the laws and due process. You were depriving the owner of wealth without due process. What a joke. So now they had to change the laws. But to change the laws, they'd have to get new lawmakers in. They'd have to vote. Well, they didn't even have the vote. So now they had to fight for the vote. To fight and agitate for the vote, they had to organize and have public demonstrations. These two were illegal. So they had to fight for the right to have public demonstrations so that they could agitate for the vote, so they could change these rules, so that they could then be able to organize at the work site. So democracy develops in conjunction with class struggle. Democracy is a component of class struggle. You following me? Okay. And that's... Yes, okay, I saw him. Yes. Okay. I just want to make sure you're not saying no when you're nodding. Like, okay, all right. So, democracy is a wonderful invention by the people of history to protect themselves against the abuses of wealth. That's what they've been doing.
What is D, E, democracy?
Democracy is rule by the demos, by the people. That is, rule a sets of procedures, political procedures, which have to do, you know, the usual ones, free speech, right to free assembly, the right to pick your leaders, the right to hold them accountable with re-elections or whatever else, and those things. That's procedural democracy, what I call procedural or political democracy. And then this democracy, historically, did not emerge in a vacuum. It emerged because of these material considerations for economic democracy. It's the same with the women's movement. Women just didn't want the vote. It wasn't just some gender ego, well, you men have the vote, so we want the vote because we're jealous, we don't have the vote. Women were facing very real liabilities and oppressions. They couldn't go to professional schools in many states. They couldn't own property. If they got property from their fathers, it became their husbands the minute they got married. They couldn't have a say. They couldn't have... working women lived under terrible conditions. Besides all the usual oppressions they suffered, they also suffered sexual oppressions of all kinds. Women throughout the social stratum suffered and still do from their relations with men. they're the victims of male violence in enormous numbers. So when women fought for the vote, they were fighting for that first entree into changing a lot of these things, you see. Of course, the vote itself doesn't magically change it. It just becomes one instrument that you can, that you use to some degree.
N, O, now, on, the, B, on the N, A, T, national, L, E, level. Does V voting do anything?
Yes, I'm not one of those people who says, it doesn't matter who gets elected. Don't tell that to the ruling class. Boy, they know it matters. Look at the attention and time and energy they give to rigging, stealing, deflecting. People. Yeah, on the national level, it does matter. Yeah.
Don't tell K E R Carrie E I don't tell Carrie either. M A make him S W sweat. Don't tell Carrie either that it matters. Make him sweat.
I'm not sure.
Because you said that you said you're one of those people that think it does matter who gets elected, which party gets elected, which person. He said, but don't tell them that or something like that. And so Frank said, and don't tell Carrie either. Make him sweat.
Yeah, could you open that? Yeah, open that door.
Yeah,
there's a strong kitty litter smell in here.
Yeah,
it's
got wax cats.
Yeah. You got a lot of kitty litter too. I don't know what to say about Carrie. What they try to do is give us a choice that isn't really much of a choice, and they often succeed in doing that. Obviously.
Yes.
You don't have to convince me about the limitations of elections. This always comes up, you see. People always pose one question, and then they argue a different proposition. They say, do elections matter? And I say, yes, they do. And then they start talking about the deficiencies of elections, the deceptions in elections. Like they got to convince me about that, right? As if I haven't written the goddamn book about it, Democracy for the Few, which is, you know, and the like. But that's not the question. That's not the question. The question is, do the elections matter? It's not, are elections perfect? Are they really so wonderfully democratic? Do they give us viable choices that will impact in ways that will bring us to our agenda? You know, and often the answer to those things are no. But that doesn't matter.
Why does it matter? Why does it matter?
I think I've just told you why it matters, because there is the choice is between someone like Carrie or Edwards. Edwards would have been much better than Carrie. As a candidate and even as a president, or the Bush gang, which is the Bush gang are the most reactionary, really the most uncompromising reactionary element of bourgeois capitalism. And with the Curry people, there's at least some leverage and we might get some kinds of protections and changes. You can't say nothing's happened. Since 1900 to today, we have made tremendous changes. It matters because I don't want to go back to child labor. It matters because I don't want to see the minimum wage abolished. It matters because I don't want to see every Clean Air, Clean Water Act undermined and destroyed. And they're doing that. They've learned from the Gingrich Republican revolution that Newt Gingrich started, that you don't announce a big revolution and go and wipe it all out. Mm. What you do is you just keep cutting chunks of it away and keep doing a lot of this through executive order or administratively. So it matters in that degree. Kerry, I'm sure, is going to be awful. He will do awful things, just the way Clinton did awful things. Clinton went and bombed Yugoslavia, a decent, stable, social democrat society, demonized the leader, and killed 6,000 people, you know, tore the country apart in a series of civil wars, pursued that whole policy. He was awful. But Bush would have been worse in his second term on a number of issues. So,
why is Bush, why is N. Nader R. running?
Why is Nader running? Nader's running very correctly because he says both of these candidates are going to be within a particular framework, and they will fail to address a lot of these issues. Nader will broaden the spectrum of debate. He will try to push the center political gravity a bit more to the left. I won't vote for him, though, as I said on Democracy Now. I voted for him last time, and even then I voted for him only because Gore was ahead 11 points here in California. But I don't think Nader should have gone into the race this time. I think it's really getting very bad and very dangerous. We're at a pivotal point, and we need to get the Bush gang out of there.
He said he will not D, he will not R, he will not D, drop out at the last minute. He says he's not going to drop out at the last minute. He's going to go all the way through.
Mm-hmm. What can I say? It proves he's not listening to me. Actually, I know him personally, and I think he's a terrific guy. And I think he's making a mistake doing this. Both for the election itself and even for himself. I don't think this is the way to go.
If he, H, A, had S, P, E, spent the L last 4 years, C, creating A, P, A,
party,
it would be D, different.
Well, maybe. Then there is a party. There are third parties on the left, and he worked with the Green Party last time, and this time he's going to run as an independent. I don't know how different it would have been. I don't know if he would have created. You just don't create a party 4 years out of whole cloth or out of the air. I mean, if there's no movement for it, if there's no backup for it, it doesn't work. It's not that easy.
Why is
there are people who, let me interrupt you, there are people who accuse Nader, and I don't want to spend too much more time on Nader, but there are people who accuse him of being an egomaniac. He's on an ego trip. I've heard this from any number of personal friends of mine. Nader doesn't care the damage he's doing. They charge him with being guilty of causing Bush's election. Nader is not an egomaniac, quite the opposite. If he had an ego, if he was worried about his public persona, he probably wouldn't be running. It's just the opposite. The man does not do things for ego. He does things because he's impelled by the issues of the day. And he feels so compelled by the injustice, by the limited debate and the limits of the dialogue that goes on here, that he feels compelled to go in to push those issues. He's consumed by the issues. These issues are not things he uses to project himself. Rather, his self gets consumed by the issues. It's like public speaking. The public speaker, Aristotle's rhetoric deals with this. The public speaker who uses the material just to project himself, like an artist singing or something, is one thing. But the public speaker who gets possessed by his issue and who talks about it because he feels it, because it's there for him, that's the one that the people believe because they know he really means it.
Yes.
And Nader is one of the latter. And so he's a really great guy. I just think he's making a mistake. Now, what happens often with these third-party candidates, it happened with all the Green candidates. I have to keep reminding Green candidates, you know, would you please criticize the Republicans and the Democrats? Oh, yes, Republicans and the Democrats. Well, what they all did was ending up attacking the Democrats, doing, therefore, the work of the Republicans, siphoning votes off. And this is the danger, because in fact they are competing with the Democrats for votes. They're not competing with that Republican base. They're not getting any of that vote. They can pretend, oh, we're going to be critical of both parties, but that's not what ends up happening. And I think this year we can't afford a third candidate. I should also point out, I don't think Nader was the cause of Gore's defeat. I think Gore was. He was a lousy debater. After every debate, Bush's ratings went up and Gore's came down. Bush has a polemical instinct. Bush follows up. Everybody thinks Bush is stupid. All my friends who I consider now stupid, increasingly stupid, every time they tell me how stupid Bush is, I say, you're stupid if you think he's stupid. This guy has the intelligence of a rat. I'm tired of hearing this. Bush is stupid. Ronald Reagan was stupid. Dwight Eisenhower was stupid. And meanwhile, they're sticking it and sticking it to us just because they flub sentences, just because they can't figure out and they can't remember things and they don't care about the particulars. So what? The ruling class doesn't want a literary genius. The ruling class isn't looking for an elocution star. They don't give a goddamn. This Bush is very smart. He's much smarter than his father. The American people did not like his father. They gave his father a 93% approval rating after the first Gulf War. And a year later, he lost the election to a garrulous governor from Arkansas because they didn't like him because he was a brittle, snotty Yaley after all these years. That's what George Bush the first was. This Bush has this populist affectation. He talks about Americans are hard-working people. They're good people. We got a good, decent society. We shouldn't be attacking and criticizing it. We're doing good things. We're solving everything. Blah blah. And he knows how to come across. He's a very effective candidate. He's much more effective than Kerry, who's another piece of wood, like Gore, who is incapable of coming out with an unengineered statement, who's incapable of a spontaneous emotion, who's incapable of getting his voice out of the ethereal strata. So people should stop focusing on this superficial aspect, the fact that Bush is dyslexic, yeah, and he gets words mixed up. I get words mixed up. Big deal. I'm a lousy speller. That's why I have someone clear that up.
Me.
That doesn't mean anything.
Me too.
You too. You're doing pretty good with this here, little blackboard of yours.
How?
Well, listen, you know, the pay isn't that good. I'm going to end it in a little while, and then you're going to have to just entertain your friends. And so, yeah, go ahead.
How did A, P, U, a punk, from B, from N, New York, get to where you are?
Well, I don't know. We don't. I was a street kid, but I don't think I was a punk. The punks, as I say, are in power.
That should be G, good for A, half hour.
No, I don't think so. Well, the way I got there was because there were all sorts of people whose names I don't even know, who fought for generations to get free public education so that someone like me from a very poor family, and we were very poor, was able to go to public school. I couldn't go to college. I had to go to work after high school. Even though I performed very well in high school, I came out in the Honors Society and all that stuff, editor of the magazine in high school. I had a lot of fun. I worked, I went to night school, then I finally went back to college, worked 20 hours a week while I was in college, worked every summer so I was able to support myself, and I could go to college because it was free, tuition free. I just had to work to be able to have some money for my expenses. So it was tuition free. I probably couldn't go to college today because the tuitions are so jacked up and you have to borrow so much money. So people from my background have a harder time today. And then even when I, after City College, which was the free school, even my advanced degrees, an MA at Brown and a PhD at Yale, came because I was able to get stipends and awards that were granted to people to do those things. So I did it because of these democratic victories we've had over the century, because of who got elected, who's been elected, and who changed certain laws and improved certain things. And that was how I was able to become a member of the academic profession, which I eventually left because I became political and had a very hard time getting jobs. I've been kicked out of some of the best universities in America. So now I do full-time writing and lecturing all over North America and Europe, and some occasionally in Europe.
Want to H E here A P a poem?
Sure.
Frank wrote this, he finished it last night.
Uh-huh.
It's called Locked In, Locked Out. Evolution searches out potential within every life form, within every experiment, flowing through change, flowing through adaptations into new possibilities. This tide wave moves everything, shapes everything, leaving everything which doesn't find the ever-changing potential within its soul behind. Just didn't live out within the dynamic dance of existence. Failures are the golden steps of expanding creation. But we civilized humans have been denied for most of the blink of our history, most of our potential. The tide wave has been dammed up. Evolution has been funneled down into a narrow, high-pressure laser focused for profit and power of the hidden few.
Most of our potential is locked in, locked away, locked out, locked up, locked away in closets, locked up in factories of meaningless work, locked away in warehouses of waiting to die. Death waits a dull lifetime to come. Locked outside the margins, locked outside on the homeless streets, locked inside the suburbs of isolation, locked within the walled communities of comforting, unreasoning fear, locked up within well-paid sitcoms, locked out, toiling in the fields, not allowed to eat the food, dying in the false famine, dying from thirst in the African dust, manufactured from bottled demand, dying from sickness, preventable, curable, locked away within the dark other, locked in the kitchen cooking artificial food of bland pretending, routine not fulfilling any need or love, locked down in chains on the sofa, on the shrink's couch, absorbing unattainable desires, locked in gridlock, not coming, not going, just sitting within unmoving isolation, listening to the latest muzak of loveless loneliness, all shining and cold, locked away in the passionless bedroom with the glass ceiling, tied down in the bed of hopelessness, tied down, locked up in the nursing home, lifetimes of wisdom dismissed and forgotten, locked up in padded cells, dangerous healing imagination, being burned up by electric shock, burning up the trash that could save us all. Locked up on death row within the isolation cells lies change. It will not die, even under tortures of 10,000 years. Just locked it up. Just lock it up, damn it up with the oily gum of dogma. Manufacture fear and mistrust of the other of difference. Pour the many flavors of this poison of bigotry from childhood and mother milk in God's image on the blackboard of coloring within the lines. Lock what's acceptable, normal, within the lines, then send these good citizens off on crusades of killing of the different other, of killing off diversity, which is the curse of profitability. The brew of bigotry blinds the eyes to red is the color of all human blood. Blinds us, too, we all are locked in, locked up, locked away on the plantations of slavery, in the sweatshops of suppression, in the factory farm fields of exploitation, in the occupied territories of closing walls, of refugee camps, of wandering Jews, of death camps, warehouses of all kinds filled with waiting to die, living hopes, dreams, loves, imaginations, cultures of the human spirit which do not fit into power, wealth, and the controlled reality. Yep, we are all in there, including most of you who believe you are the masters and the guards in your dank cubbyholes of fears and addictions. And within our cells we have been digging throughout the ages, underground passages, linking passions together. When we reach to touch one another, the bars melt like butter. We sing together in words that the masters can't understand. We create together, dream, imagine together. We hope and make love together behind the dam in evolution. The silly, mentally retarded girl giggles as she runs to hug an absolute stranger. This is hope of evolution. The police hose fires high-pressure profits, blasting of shortages through the dam's hole, business as usual. But it looks like evolution is about to burst through the dam. Will it destroy all of us? Who knows? We always have lived with doomsday, judgment day, around the corner. Sometimes it came, sometimes it didn't. But I'm betting that our underground potential will be released in the coming flood and will expand. But then this is written by a guy who was supposed to have died long ago in one of those death cells. There's always hope hidden up our sleeves.
Well, pretty impressive poem. Very good. Just say their dank holes and their addictions. They live very well. They don't have any dank holes in real. I mean, it's sort of their spirits are in the dank hole, but they have the best of everything there is to get, and they know it, and they love it, and they really enjoy it. There's a myth that the rich are unhappy. They're very happy. I mean, they could be unhappy not because they're rich, because they're miserable. But they get serviceable things. Their lives are much easier than ours. I mean, you're talking about people who never have to in their lives look for a parking space. They never have to wait for a bus or a trolley or be caught in a traffic jam. They never have to sit in the doctor's office waiting. They never have to call up a travel agent to try to arrange flights or travel or all that. They never have to clean dishes or clothes or house. These are all things that I do myself. They never have to do any of these things. They live superlatively. They never have to see unpleasant sights. They live tremendously. It is also true, though, they are addicted. They suffer from the most dangerous addiction that you have in history, and that's the addiction of wealth. Mm. Wealth is addictive. The more that you possess, the more you want. The idea that after you accumulate this immense amount of wealth, that you are going to have to divide it up among three sons was just so disturbing to many people that the European aristocracy put in the rule of primogeniture, that it all goes to one son. It wasn't because the firstborn is to be so favored, but it's because the wealth and power and name of this family will not maintain itself if you break it up into four kids or something. So you have to keep this great estate together. It's a projection of yourself beyond your grave, even. So wealth becomes even almost a substitute for immortality, or an expression of one's immortality. And so this is definitely what we're facing. Very good, very good, very, very impressive poem, Frank. I'm sure your listeners appreciated it too, and you're going to be assailed with requests for copies of the poem. But is there a door someplace where the kitty litter is, which you can close it off, please?
Yeah.
You might want to make it a policy when someone comes that you change the litter that day and you air out the house a bit, because it's really killing me.
Yeah, it's closed.
Yeah, I see an instant change right there. Yeah.
Every even, O, U, our, K, I, kid, G, O, got, T, R, I, tricked, by, the, A, D, D, addiction, to, of money.
Have I ever gotten?
No, he said even our kid, Koala, he's like 30 years old now, and he's been an activist his whole adult life and lived on an organic farm and been very politically active, and he's now studying acupuncture with his girlfriend in Santa Cruz. And but he has friends that are more our age that have money, that are successful and have money. And Frank always likes to name names. Noah's Bagels, the guy who started Noah's Bagels and then sold it and made a lot of money and now doesn't do anything. You know, doesn't have a job.
Bagels, yeah. I mean, as someone who came from New York,
right?
Those aren't bagels.
Exactly.
But the people out here don't know the difference, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah. But when Koala was, or P, I, pizza, he doesn't make pizza, but you're making a distinction between New York pizza and the pizza you get around here. Yeah. Koala bought into the idea that, so he's friends with this guy.
Oh, the cheese board has excellent pizza.
It's
the best I've ever had. I don't even particularly like pizza, but I always eat their pizza because it's so good.
I don't know R&L. I don't either.
A-R-I-N-E-L-L.
Yeah.
Where is Arnelli? Maybe it was Arnelli.
Yeah. But when he talks, so he's friends with this guy, and he talks about, that the position he's in seemed to be an enviable position, that you get yourself a lot of money and then you can do good for the people.
Do they do good? Do they end up doing good?
I mean, we don't really know a lot about what he does, although It's
when people do this, like Ben and Jerry or George Soros or a few others, they do good in very marginal ways. They come out for against this issue or
like
that.
He is like that.
Yeah,
like the guys you're mentioning.
Yeah, they don't confront the core issues that we're talking about.
And F E feel guilty. Yeah, feel guilty. That was the one thing that Koala thought was because a problem. You know, there's the guilt that goes with being having a lot of money. Even though he's doing a lot of good, he has all these guilt issues that then translate into headaches and physical problems. And how do you get around that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. G-H-E. Hey. Give. Yeah, Frank said, hey, give us some of that money and we'll take care of his guilt and use it for lover and all the things we're doing. Give. Three. Of. His. Four. H. Oh, houses to the B to the H homeless.
Yeah, things like that.
Yeah, with on that level of wealth, like Ben and Jerry's, what could people in that position effectively do, you know, that would get at the core and still be able to maintain their position?
Well, they may run into real risks if they start talking about the power of corporations and class war and the need for people to really fight back and, you know, to do the hardcore things. They may find distributors not taking them. They may find that they don't get advertising anymore in the mainstream. They might find their very business, even if it's a multi-million dollar business, it's relatively small compared to, you know, Enron or Texaco or somebody like that. So they can't address things
at that level.
Right. They
If they step it down, what can approach addressing that without it being sort of founded?
Well,
you know what I'm saying?
Talking about democracy, opposing the U.S. Patriot Act, let's say, arguing that there must be a different way to fight terrorism. Look, we've been fighting terrorism now for 3 years almost with George Bush. We've destroyed two countries. We've killed tens of thousands of people, and just yesterday we see a massive terrorist attack in Madrid, killing people and all, and we may be slated next. It's obviously not an approach that's working. It doesn't deal with what the causes of terrorism is. So they might be able to join that issue, for instance.
You think they could get away with that without attracting too much attention? That would shut them down?
Oh, it's quite the contrary. They wouldn't get any attention. More likely, they would end up not having much attention. What I'd like to see, if all these reformist-minded millionaires, if they all got together and bought a network, for instance, that might be better. Even then, you can't sustain it. Al Franken has this radio program now. It's going to be very hard to sustain, just in terms of getting people who foot the bill for that program. You see,
H. E. Hey, if we
can. Do you really need to say hey, for Christ's sake? you don't think we know you're talking? Jeez. Golly, good, right, golly. You got all the time in the world, aren't you?
He doesn't do golly. If we can,
even you need a little editing there. I know how to shut you up now. You just go like, yeah. Yeah.
If we can do lover.
But we're talking about small again. We're talking about small.
Lover is on a small scale. Why? Why don't R-U-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-C-H-R-I-
do it on their scale.
Liberals do very little without the prodding of radicals to push them.
Yes.
That's true of even organizing. Liberals do very little of liberal political work without radicals doing. Mostly radicals who organize the demonstrations, as radicals who launch the electoral struggles and such. Liberals don't know what to do. They're too busy. They're too busy trying to get along with conservatives generally. What's happened now recently is very interesting, because some of my liberal friends are sounding like me. They're very angry. They're very alarmed. They're very, very concerned intensely at a level I haven't seen them before. They are realizing that there's some real things at stake. And so maybe they'll be moving. You could say the same thing about the U.S. labor movement. In all those years, you think they could have, you think, given the treatment that they've been accorded by the business-owned corporate media and newspapers, you think they could have started a newspaper. But they have no media consciousness. I don't understand how you can have a massive, century-old labor union movement in this country and not one or two or five people coming out with the idea of let's get a radio station, let's get networking, let's start doing something, let's start taking our issue before the public. Every there's an immense labor press. There are hundreds of people who write, but they're all house organs. You pick up one of them, and there's the picture of the leader on every page, shaking hands with this guy, shaking hands with that guy. And
I wonder if my brother-in-law would come on the show next time he comes out here.
And what does he do?
He's a president of the AFL-CIO in New York.
There's one publication, United Auto Workers. Their publication is called Solidarity, and that does deal with issues of some social content. And that's a legacy from they had the best labor union leader that America produced in the last half century, Walter Reuther, who was killed, I believe, deliberately killed. So so you'll find a few labor publications that have some issues. You know, they'll talk to the workers, say, "Oh, we're going overtime is going to be abolished. We got to mobilize." Or if the issues are directly involved with the membership, then they do it.
But no. O. V. Over. V. Overview, but no overview.
Yeah, generally no overview. And I've spoken before labor union groups. Part of the problem of the leadership is they're dealing with membership that is not immune to the dominant paradigm and the ideological hegemony of the society. So I spoke, for instance, to Firefighters Association, the state convention in Washington State. Well, the leadership were people who were all totally open to me. They... one of the top guys, the second in command, said, "I've read all your books. I went to Parenti University. I never went to college, blah, blah, blah." And but the membership were all, you know, I walk in the room and there's 500 white guys. A third of them are in the reserves. They're flag wavers. They think George Bush is great because he's protecting America from a mortal enemy in Iraq who's about to pounce on us and kill us all. So sometimes it's hard and often the people who go into union organizing are politically more literate and politically more savvy and more progressive than their rank and file. Mm-hmm. So that also becomes one of the problems that they have, and that may explain why they they don't do more in the larger arena.
We get RAD, radical groups
that approach us because they know that we've been doing Lover for a bunch of years and they want to do some internet thing like this. And so they'll come to us and ask if,
what's wrong? Am I not?
Yeah.
Is that working now? Okay. We'll have radical groups who know about Lover that we've been going for many years, and they want to do some internet things. So they'll come to us and they'll say, can you give us tips on how to do it? And we'll show them how to do it cheap, which is the way we do it. Mm-hmm. And they won't be interested if we aren't talking thousands and thousands and thousands of listeners. If it's anything less than that, then they don't want to do it. And then they can't afford to do it at that level, mm-hmm. So then they don't do anything. And
so you have a small audience, a small but fairly devoted one. Do you get much feedback? Do you have a sense of reaching people, connecting with people?
50 50,000 a month.
That's a cumulative figure, you mean?
Is that the way it works?
After four Sundays?
Yes. If you add all the numbers up, it's 50,000 people.
Which isn't 50,000 because you're having repeats. You're having regulars who listen, maybe.
Right.
Maybe it'd be less than 50, but yes. Anyway.
Yes.
50,000 viewings by whatever number.
Yes.
Well, that's a pretty good size audience. That's usually larger than the ones I usually address. So.
Where, as they don't even try, right? These groups don't even try because they're so locked into. If it's not as big as like CNN or something, it's not worth doing.
Yeah, well, that's unusual because generally, people in alternative media understand that they're not going to get mainstream audiences. So these people just seem unusually unrealistic. Mm. Let's see. God, look at it. They ate half of this thing. I'll be up all night.
Everybody saw this.
You know? Oh, well, why not? Are your viewers watching me eat chocolate now?
Betcha.
There you go.
Yeah, there they are.
So we do have a commercial, you see. Maybe it's time for you to hold up my book.
Yeah, The Assassination of Julius Caesar.
Let me tell you. The History of Ancient Rome by Michael Parenti. Let me tell you one iron law about people who do media on a non-professional basis. never tell your audience who you're talking to. Go an hour, go 2 hours, never stop and say, we are talking to. Right. Would you maybe defy that iron law now? And
we're pretty much.
Tell the audience.
We have mentioned your name, Michael Parenti, 4 or 5 times.
Really?
Yeah, every time.
Well, with the book.
With
yeah.
the book, yeah. Yeah.
But I always find, I have to tell people, when I'm listening, or when I'm listening to radio and I hear somebody, and I'm interested, I tune in the middle of something, who is this person? You can't get it. And go on. But if you got people who have learned about that, there is something to be said about professional. Yeah. They say, we are speaking to blah, 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 blah. Yeah. Terry Gross, as much as I detest her, she at least says, we are speaking to.
Yeah.
So For the benefit of your future guests.
People like you who have been on a lot of these kinds of shows, you manage to get your name in a bunch. We do have a lot of guests like that who have figured that out and that they have to say their name a lot.
Well, I think one advantage of not...
No, wait. They have to say their name a lot.
Well, if they
it, might, it just might be a nice idea to tell your listeners who you're talking to.
Because
I'm sorry, I am not instantly recognizable by all 50,000 of your viewers. There are a lot of people who are going to say, this is interesting. What is this about? Where can I find more? Who is this guy you're talking to? Okay.
You. What? Oh, sorry. You are. Oh, yes. You are my... No. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, you are. He's saying, oh, yes, you are recognizable to most of our people.
Right.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, if somebody tunes in and hears what you're saying without hearing your name, maybe they've heard your name like, that guy, that radical guy. They hear you talking for a while and it makes sense to them. And then they hear your name and they're like,
that's so lame. Let's get back to some political stuff. That's
I don't know
so
if you
lame.
Know where I'm
just,
going
just,
with that.
Yeah, just don't go there, will you? It's so lame.
That back to you, Frank.
Let's get back to some political
that
things.
That is why
we've got a few more minutes.
That is why she is my student.
Right, because she pursues Jesuistic polemics.
I don't know. It's happened to me that I've listened to the radio. You know, I've been fed the propaganda like everybody else. You know, this person's a radical. They're full of bullshit. Then I'll listen to the radio and I hear somebody who talks a lot of sense. And then it says, oh, no, this is so-and-so.
Wait a minute.
I was supposed to think that
they were out there. That's exactly, this is so-and-so. That's the part that's missing from the picture, generally. That's when you're interviewed by people who are self-generating media. But just letting you know for the benefit of your future guests. Go ahead.
What is N.E. next?
What do you mean, what's next?
For Michael? Or and for the...
The world. I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know. I don't know. None of us could predict, you know. When Bush went into Iraq, we couldn't say. People, what's going to happen now that he's in Iraq? I don't know. And look what happened. A people's resistance emerged. Nobody predicted it. Nobody predicted that. I conjectured, but I did it more not as a prediction, but as a hope. I remember saying to one or two friends, just saying, he may be biting off more than he can chew. I was just hoping that this whole policy would, you know, backfire. But I couldn't predict it. Nobody, who can predict? I don't know. What we have to do is keep struggling and trying to make certain changes. I would like to see a real grassroots movement that could do tax resistance, because if you don't pay your taxes, they can't go on with things. It's a very hard thing to do, though, because you end up being harassed and they take your car, your house, throw you in prison, whatever else. But there must be ways that we could do it. The ruling class doesn't pay their taxes. Something we got to do there.
C-O-R. Corporations are do that. Why not us? Corporations do that, meaning not pay their taxes, so why not us?
Right. Yeah. If we didn't pay, of course, because they're not being collected, right? The U.S. Treasury estimates that about $70 billion a year is lost on offshore tax havens that are technically legal. Well, they're like the mafia again. The mafia doesn't pay taxes on their earnings, and so these guys don't pay also. If we did it, it would be more of a political act and rather than just a matter of tax evasion for the sake of evasion.
There's a whole economy of people earning a living, exchanging goods and services under the table.
Right. That's true.
What? Is that a wrap?
Well,
hey, that's a wrap.
I think that's a wrap.
That's a wrap.
Good. We've done it. We've
now, our guest tonight has been Michael Parenti, and check out his new book, Kirsten.
The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome, Michael Parenti, put out by the New Press.
And your website is michaelparenti.org.
Right. Yes. www.michaelparenti.org.
Before he runs out of the door, what? Get that website out there and his name, right? Okay, so this is all archived on lover.com under Frank Moore Shaman's Den Archives, the audio of this. And also you can go to Radio for All and listen to it as well. B.
There it is.
B. Do you want to say anything else? Play's going to stop. Hit play again.